But what the myth has to provide, I mean, just on this immediate level of life instruction, the pedagogical aspect of myth, it has to give life models. And the models have to be appropriate to the possibilities of the time in which you're living.
I think most people would agree that myths are great vehicles to convey morals and universal truths. But for me, a person interested in studying ancient Christian texts, it raises a more interesting question. Can myth be scripture? Let's explore how this thought can be applied to the apocryphal story of Susanna. This story is among the apocryphal writings in the Septuagint, but not in Protestant Bibles. So, Susanna is a beautiful Hebrew woman who is accosted by two Jewish elders hiding in her garden. The two elders threaten to claim she was meeting a young man unless she has sex with them. Gross. Susanna doesn't give in to the blackmail, goes to trial, is accused and sentenced to death, when all of a sudden Daniel, yeah, the guy from the lion's den, Daniel busts in and Sherlock Holmes style deduces the mystery. He interrogates the two elders and neither of their stories match up. One says the incident happened under a mastic tree, the other elder maintains it happened under an evergreen oak tree. They're ultimately found guilty and condemned. Case closed, mystery solved. The story was written for diaspora Jews during the Babylonian exile. It's referred to as one of the diaspora novellas, not to be confused with a telenovela. But one question persists. Why does the story appear in some Bibles, but not others? Is this story scripture? Let's talk about it. So this happens in the apocryphal books.
Yeah.
Which, and maybe you can help with this too.
Okay.
The term apocryphal and deuterocanonical, those are two terms used to describe the same group of books. Mm-hmm. But depending on which term it is, it's referring to the status of that book. So, you know, the Protestants will call these apocryphal books because it's not in their Bible.
Mm-hmm.
But
even though it used to be until they recreated their Bible.
Right. Oops, mm-hmm. Forgot. But the Catholics would say this is deuterocanonical.
Absolutely. Because they still use it.
What does deuterocanonical mean? What does that mean?
So, good question. So canonical means that it's part of the canon, right? And how the deutero part gets used when you're talking about the deuterocanonical, it probably means having more of a legal connotation to it, right? And of course, you don't have a canon,
right,
in Christianity until the 5th century, right? When the guys sit down and go, oh, this is in and this is out, when they're trying to figure out what is heretical. Mm-hmm. You can't say something is heretical until you say what's mm-hmm. orthodox, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's quote unquote late, right? Relatively speaking,
that
if we're
is
talking
pretty
about 2,000 years of a religious tradition, and it doesn't get set until, you know, a quarter of the way through its history, and then 1,000 plus or minus years later, it gets thrown out. Susanna's only in for like half of the tradition for sort of everybody, and not everybody, right? So the it's in the Roman Catholic and the Eastern Orthodox tradition. It's not in the Protestant, according to Article 6 of the 39 Articles of the Church of England.
Yes.
Right? See, I looked this up.
I'm so glad you have those articles. There's a chart in the Oxford book.
Oh, is there a chart?
Yeah, it's got like a bullet point next to like which ones are. Look at that chart.
Oh my gosh, it's so
bad. But it's exactly what you just said.
There we go, right? She's just kind of all over the place. And then the Jews don't have her. And not only, so here's what's funny is she's not in the Jewish canon of the Tanakh at all, ever, right? She's never there. And yet she's in the Septuagint, which means that for some, you know, they were exporting it as in, or they had it, if it was always in Greek, someone's like, yeah, let's get Susanna in for you know, the guys in Egypt, right? Because they'll like that. Because
they need to hear this story.
They need this story,
for some reason or another, yeah.
Correct. And then, hold on, I have some other funny notes. Right, and then when Jerome was translating for the Vulgate, she wasn't in.
Right?
She wasn't there. So how'd she get in
at
all, right? Because in the 4th century, she wasn't in. But by the 5th century, there she is, right? So none of it makes any sense. And then
why is the story included sometimes but not other times? And who's making those decisions?
Exactly. And Origen received the story. as part of the divine book. So Origen had it, Jerome didn't, the Jews of Alexandria hadn't, the rest of the Jews didn't. It was in Roman Catholic and Eastern Christian tradition. And then the Protestants are like, we're getting the, you know, the pictures of the dirty lady out of here.
Right, right.
Which, truth be told, it wouldn't shock me that that's one of the reasons why she got booted, right? Like, I could imagine, you know, Luther going, oh, you can make dirty pictures of her, get rid of her, or something right. like that, right? I mean, in terms of legitimacy.
Yeah.
Well, that was me being trite and petty.
Right, right.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Well, true. Well, since you've started kind of contextualizing this, let's talk about that a little bit more.
Okay.
Because I know, well, so this book, this short story of Susanna, it's very short.
It's 64 verses.
It's very short. It's meant to be a little short story. Most of the time it's included as like a little piece at the end of Daniel.
Right.
Or it's in the separate apocryphal section.
Right. Sometimes it is the end of Daniel. Yeah.
So it's also got this kind of courtroom trial thing going on, mm-hmm. and it's the only, I might be wrong, but it's the only courtroom trial story that doesn't have to do with other cultures. Mm-hmm. There's no Persian stuff involved. There's no Babylonian stuff. It's a Jewish court thing going on.
Yeah.
And I know you did your dissertation on Shalman Azar, and you know tons of Persian stuff.
He's not Persian. He's Assyrian.
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 My bad.
He's or before the Persians.
I edit these.
Good answer. Actually, very good answer. So were his texts, by the way. Yeah. Actually, he's the first person to refer to the Persians.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a legitimate, quantifiable, historical thing that we can refer to with some confidence.
Shalman Susanna? Azar. Oh, Shalman Azar is. Yeah. He was like a real person, and he refers to people in the Hebrew Bible as real people, and he refers to the Persians as like this new group on the scene. Yeah, he's like real.
That's so cool.
I know.
Because that's where the archaeological stuff
everything
comes
hits,
alive.
All of it becomes real right there.
So can you – what's going on? This is – can you describe the – just like the general timeline of the Hebrews? They're in exile.
Oh, okay.
But they weren't in exile. They say this book was written during the exile.
Got it.
How does this come to be?
Okay. So there's the narrative history as presented – in the Hebrew Bible. And then there's the history as we can figure out what's going on from the outside. And in some places they're the same. And in some places, like, what?
That's the stuff.
All over the map, right? So according to the Hebrew Bible, there is this family of descendants from Abraham who people want to date all over the place, anywhere between like 1800-ish. Some people want to put them earlier. So anywhere between from the early, late second millennium before Common Era to as, you know, to fill in the blank yesterday,
right.
if you want.
Right.
All right. So he has like this series of things, and he ends up having a descendant, Joseph, in Egypt, who he and all of his brothers are down in Egypt. And then they, 400 years later, exit Egypt under Moses, right? And there's no evidence for any of that, but let's not get obsessed with details. So then, supposedly, according to the narrative in the biblical text, all these guys go back home, all of that's in air quotes, and they go back into the land, which is the land of modern day Israel and parts of Jordan and parts of, depending on how big you want to make it, Egypt and southern Lebanon and even Syria if you want to go hog wild. So then in the books of Joshua and Judges, this group of people take over the land, and simultaneously the book admits that they don't take over the land. And there are other people that were there who have always been there, and they're called various ites, but mostly Canaanites. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So then, and none of this, there's no data proving any of this.
There's nothing.
Footprints
or tools or...
You know, you could reach and argue that you have a bunch of people showing up in Egypt as slaves in the Middle Bronze Age, and then they kind of take over in the Late Bronze Age. And some people would argue this is a remnant of a memory of Joseph and Jacob. And some people would say, yeah, if you take any big, huge gross generalizations, you're going to find a match anywhere.
Right.
All right. And then in the end of, well, so narratively speaking still, according to the Hebrew Bible, right? So then you have Saul, which is this guy who tries to unify everybody. Mm-hmm. He's kind of unsuccessful at best.
Kind of.
Yeah. As we've discussed in class. Then you have David, who the biblical text argues is uber successful in everything he does. You know, he can womanize with the best of them. Just ask Gregory Peck. And so, because he played him. And so he like unifies the northern tribes, which is what is known as northern Israel today, and Judah in the south.
And then, we'll see some of that villainization in this text too. Sort of the north is
bad
and this is Susanna's a good old, you know.
She's good.
Yeah.
Susanna's really good though. She really is good.
Yeah, she's great.
So then according to still the narrative in the Hebrew Bible, then there's following Solomon, who has this big, huge building project and even has contacts with the Queen of Sheba, which is variously Ethiopia or Yemen or somewhere around there because they're close to each other. So she even comes and visits. And then following Solomon through overtaxation, you have a split in the kingdom and you have northern Israel, which are the 10 tribes, and southern Israel, which is Judah and like the remnant of Simeon that gets kind of absorbed, right? Simeon. And then you have the north, which like gets along and doesn't get along with the south, and sometimes they're married to each other and sometimes they're not. And then the north comes into contact finally with Shalmaneser III, my guy,
yes.
Right? In the 9th century BCE. And they come into contact because northern Israel, led by Ahab and then, mostly Ahab. Later we get a reference to Omri. And he is in this coalition of like 11 other states that are fighting the Assyrians militarily, right? Mm-hmm. And he's got a ton of chariots and horses and stuff. And we've got this whole long list and they're all mad and Shalmaneser's mad and Shalmaneser claims to defeat them, blah, 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 which of course is what he's going to say he does because he's an Assyrian king and he said it in his inscription. So then later on, right, and at that point, they are naming Israel with a king who we know from the Hebrew Bible. Shalmaneser III is a king who we can identify through his inscriptions, through his buildings, through contacts that he has with other ancient Near Eastern people who we know, right? So we're now in the realm of fact, right?
So it's fair to say that one of the only archaeological records of anything connected to
the
Hebrew
first
Bible.
One. Then after Shalmaneser III, then we have a series of Assyrian kings who refer to people from the Bible as historical contemporaries. Not an unbroken list, but almost, right? And so then we know from Shalmaneser on, we're in the realm of history. We can identify people, players, names, their friends, blah, blah, blah.
That's cool.
Yes, right. So it's a huge, important date, right? And then we start running into people who refer back to things, right? So they will refer back to Beit David, the House of David. They will refer back to others. And then our question becomes how real is that? And then there's this other inscription of Merneptah, who is the son of Ramses II, who is an Egyptian king, who refers to this group called Israel with a signifier suggesting that it's a people who don't have a land, right? So you kind of get the sense of they're like running around. And he would be the king under whom the Israelites departed. He'd be like the brother of Moses in the palace kind of guy, right?
So
we have this intriguing reference suggesting that there's some notion of some group called Israel prior to my guy Shalmaneser, right? So then we have this disjointed kingdom, but according to the biblical text, they're hanging out with each other, they're fighting with each other, they're intermarrying with each other. And we have the Assyrians seemingly not knowing that there's any contact between the two, right? So when Tiglath-Pileser III, who's the first person who refers to Judah, he says, I went to Judah, which is very far away. Well, if Judah and Israel border each other, how much farther away could Judah be when they've been in contact with Israel, you know, for a while already, right?
Right.
So then from then on, all of these characters are sort of referenced. The Assyrian kings refer to the Judean and Israelite kings because they're known entities. Then somebody destroys Israel, and it's unclear if it's Shalmaneser the IV or Sargon the II, because it seems to happen in the interim between the death of one and the taking of the throne of the other one, which again, that happens, you know, they're far away, they die, there's a blah, 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 nobody knows. And so the biblical text doesn't state categorically who destroys Northern Israel. So then they exile Northern Israel, and it was standard operating procedures of the Assyrians to remove whole populations of people, right, and move them somewhere else, right? That was standard policy. And then you bring another group of exiled people and put them in where the previous ones had been. It doesn't look like they did that much because archaeologically you can't really see. You kind of have like this blank period in northern Israel, not only of places that claim to be Israel, but even places that weren't, right? So so then the Assyrians get destroyed by the Babylonians, and the Babylonians come in and they're like doing their thing. And then everybody in the Levant seems to like have a tizzy fit against the Babylonian king. He just comes over and just destroys everybody, right?
Like plows just plows through everything,
right? Just destroys all these places. And for example, at Ekron, which is the ancient name, it's the Tell is Mikne, right? We had like all these people burying their goodies next to pillars and stuff, thinking that they were going to come back and get their goodies, and they never came back, right? So you can, and it's not, no one lives there ever again kind of a thing. So you have that throughout the region. The one exception is in the area, and Judah is destroyed by the Babylonians as well. And the thing about the when the Assyrians destroy the north is they, in the Bible, it tells us where they go. We don't know where those places are, but it tells us where they go, right? So they're missing, right? They're the lost 10 tribes, and they periodically show up in England or Alaska or Hawaii or, you know, wherever you want a lost tribe to show up, right?
Yeah, down there in Inglewood.
Right. I mean, you know, they could be anywhere, right? And what seems to happen is they just sort of like get absorbed into wherever they were, right? So, but not so much with Judah, right? And so Judah gets exiled to Babylon, and their king goes first, and we have records of him being held hostage by, you know, the king of the Babylonians, blah, blah, blah. And then you start, and the community at this point seems, something seems to happen, and they retain their identity as an exported community. And instead of being absorbed into the local population or whatever, they seem to retain and maintain this exilic identity. And a lot of people would argue that that's when the biblical texts are written, redacted, composed. They took all these sort of floating around records and turned them into a book, partially in an effort to maintain some kind of an identity. And what happens, I think, is that this is when, prior to that, the people who lived in Judah were devotees of the God of Judah, who was rooted in Jerusalem, who has the name that then becomes whatever you want to call that name. Jews aren't supposed to know it, so why would I spend time trying to pronounce
trying to
it correctly,
it,
right? It's just not interesting to me. So that deity, right, then when they move to Babylon, when they're exiled, and this is where it gets interesting, is rather than saying, like all the other ancient Near Eastern groups did, rather than saying, oh, our God went on vacation and so this happened to us, or our God lost, or our God died, or we have a bad God, or any of those things, which traditionally is what you say when your God loses and you get taken over and you get brought into exile, and you go, oh, well, their God's better because they're mm-hmm. not in exile, right? Rather than doing that, right, which makes sense, these guys said, you know what? Our God's the top dog, but he's punishing us because we didn't do what we were supposed to do. And if we only do what we're supposed to do, then blah, 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 everything will be good, right? And so it kind of looks like an exile as a way to maintain group identity and have a good God, right? They recraft all of this stuff, theologically speaking, so that they've got proof that A, their God picked them out for some special thing, which is to be exiled forevermore, B, to do all these weird rituals to maintain their identity, C, to focus only on that God, which is sort of out of the realm of normal procedure in the ancient Near East, and D, you know, I don't know what anymore, right? But, and so right, that's right. when, and that's when I would argue that the self-identity of the group shifts from the word Yehudi meaning a Judean to it meaning Jewish, right? Because they're no longer residents of Judah and therefore practicing the religion of the city and region, you know, kingdom, as it were, of Judah, but they're actually practicing some religion that's not quite as tied to place and killing animals in a sanctuary, on top of a hill in Jerusalem, right? And so there's this big, huge shift, and it happens in Babylon. So then Ezra and Nehemiah decide everybody's got to go back and blah, blah, blah. And not everybody wants to go back, right? Because some people are doing well in Babylon, right?
Yeah.
So Ezra and Nehemiah have to convince all these people to go back and rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. And some people would argue that the temple in Jerusalem, when it gets rebuilt, is not purely for religious purposes, but for the Persian, it serves a financial thing because that's where and how you gather taxes, right? So the Persians, right? So you can view the Persians as anointed ones who let the Jews go back and rebuild their temple, which is how they are treated, right? Cyrus is an anointed one, a messiah of sorts.
Wow.
Yeah. Cyrus is like good.
So we're explaining the world through our
theology. The entire world is being explained right now. Absolutely. So he gets explained as really good because he lets them go back, while at the same time, the return to Jerusalem is partially functioning for the Persians as a means of justifying their paying taxes. So you can have your temple, but that's where we're going to store the taxes. And as long as you keep paying your taxes, we're good. Go back, right? And they kind of want people to start rebuilding in the region because they're trying to take over Egypt. And it's the stepping stone into that, right?
Wow.
So there's these sort of international socioeconomic things at play, and then this sort of funky theological shift going on simultaneously. So that's where Bible and theology kind of interact. And the archaeology, which is wonderful, as you will soon learn, it can show you that a site's been destroyed. It can't tell you when it was destroyed. That's what you have to figure out, right? And it can't tell you why it was destroyed. And it can't tell you necessarily who destroyed it and why, but it can support a lot of this stuff. And one of the things that it shows is that the area of Benjamin doesn't get destroyed quite the same way that everything else does, which is why you end up with Benjaminites in like the Book of Esther,
right,
of all
right,
places.
Right.
Is that where you wanted me to go?
Absolutely. Okay. It's a perfect setup because it's
there. We go.
It brings us to this bizarre story. But just to summarize, so we've got Solomon who builds this awesome temple.
Correct. According to the Bible.
Right. And then the Assyrians come and destroy it.
The Assyrians don't
destroy it. Someone destroys it.
Yeah. It gets destroyed. The final fell is by the Babylonians.
Got it. And then the Babylonians come in and wipe out everything. And so that's First Temple period? Is that what that's
called? Yeah. So the Babylonians destroy the First Temple period. So then the under the Persian period, they come back and they build like their temple, but it's probably like some little, you know, nothing to write home about kind of a thing. But then Herod the Great, who's trying to suck up to the Romans, and I mean, it depends on how you define great. He was a great builder, right?
Mm-hmm.
He builds this big, huge second temple thing and reconstructs all of Jerusalem, blah, blah, blah. But prior to Herod, the second temple was And the Second Temple, one could argue, is never fully completed. But the Jerusalem that Jesus knows is Herod's Second Temple, not the Second Temple that Ezra and Nehemiah built.
Wow. Great little distinction.
Yeah.
That might be soundbite when we do this Crusades podcast.
Yeah, there
that's
we go.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But, and that's a huge distinction, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Because when Herod builds his Second Temple, which he's probably doing for political reasons
too,
right?
And Jesus probably hates that, yeah.
Right, exactly. So he redoes the landscape, right? So you have this mountain, and then he builds this big, you know, fills in the, so that the Western Wall is basically a retaining wall, right? And they build this thing, and then they fill it in so that they have this big, huge platform.
Got it.
Right? And so where the Dome of the Rock and Al-Azhar are right now is built on this big, huge, fake platform that Herod built.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that these stories take on a different color when you consider what's going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So this group of people at this point, they've been exiled, they lost their land. We need to retain some sense of self. Let's tell some stories to maintain these like core tenets, and let's write things down. Let's call ourselves something new. Let's say we're Jewish.
Right. And we'll use the same word, but we will re-signify it, right? So it means something different, right?
Right. That's great, like, context setting.
Right.
So let's do this. Okay. Normally you and I, we start reading in Hebrew and we stop every other word and go English. We don't have this in Hebrew.
Correct.
This isn't in Hebrew, so we got to do it backwards.
Correct.
So let's read it in English.
There we go.
And every time something is a red flag to you—
I'll scream.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. All right. So I've got—
And I didn't even bring mine. Shame on me. I was—
No, that means you can listen and go, whoa.
Oh, I love that. Okay.
And just so folks know, I'm using the New Oxford Annotated Bible with the Apocrypha, which is a really cool—
It's great.
Book, I think. I think the commentary's not biased, and it's you know.
And I love that you are marking your pages with money.
It's a $2 bill.
I know.
You know, at one point when I had some money, like
before you started grad school.
Yeah. I would have $10 bills as my bookmarks. But now it's just the random $2 bill. Okay, so this story was probably written during this exilic period, during the exile.
Correct. That's what most people would argue.
Okay.
And most, you know, depending on who you speak to, most people would argue that everything is exilic. You know, so there's a bunch of people who'd argue, and we have references to some stuff that is pre-exilic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just because you can tell, for example, the Song of Deborah, it has older components to it, so it has to be older. It's the same thing with the Miriam song, right?
Right.
You know, we just got, but the rest of it's kind of a crapshoot. And so there are some people that argue, no, it's much older and it's only redacted in the Persian period. And other people are like, yeah, right.
This thing can't, and I'll go on my huge tangent later about like Greek constructions and redacting the story. But this, and let me just say, I'm not a pro at Greek yet, but there's so many things in here that have to be in Greek to function, right? And there's examples like that in the New Testament too, which fascinate me too. So
correct. And keeping in mind that when the Septuagint, which is the first translation of the Hebrew Bible into another language, and it's translated into Greek, right? So some things they translate, and some things they transliterate, and some things they like miss its Hebrew connection, but they've created a new Greek connection that takes it a totally different way, right? Because as soon as you translate, you're interpreting.
Absolutely.
And so it fits more. And not only do you interpret, but also you can say things in one language that you can't say in another, and vice versa, right? And so words are connected in different ways in different languages. And so there's certain things that you just can't say in Greek that you can say in Hebrew. And there are things and ways that you think in Greek that just don't translate into Hebrew. And so it is the translator's choice, right? Whether are we translating close to the original, or are we trying to make it palatable to our group?
Mm-hmm.
And are we trying to shift the focus because we actually don't like what we think that means, but we're kind of into this,
right?
So there's a whole bunch of ways that one can play with that.
And if it were the option where they were, for lack of a better term, covering up something or fixing
mm-hmm.
something, subsequent readers would have no idea.
Correct.
They would read that.
Correct.
And
as
think
fact.
That was it.
Because if English was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for me. Right? I mean,
right.
That's like the notion, right? And the irony is that for the longest time, right, the Bible was in Latin, right? And it was illegal, right? Like off with your head kind of illegal to translate it into any kind of vernacular language,
right.
even though Latin was like a vernacular language when it was originally translated into Latin.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And so, you know, you forget what came before you, and that becomes, you know, King James or bust, right?
Yeah.
It's not King James, it's not the Bible, right?
Right?
Even
right.
though that's a vernacular translation from a vernacular translation from a vernacular translation of an original.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people might not know what translation of a translation of a translation means, because people throw out that term a lot, but that's what that means when it switches language and there's that some transliteration interpretation stuff that also changes.
Yep.
That is a translation of a translation of a translation.
Right.
Real quick, can you, who is this written for? Because we mentioned that it's written for the Greek-speaking Jews, and then as soon as the Christians adopt it, they say, oh, no more
right.
with that. So who's this written for?
Susanna.
Oh, the Septuagint.
Well, the Septuagint, so, okay, so you have the first exile, and some of the Jews get sent to Babylon, and some actually go to Egypt, right? And so you have this sort of bifurcation of the communities, and the Septuagint is translated in the second or third century BCE, right? So if the exile is in 586, this is like 200-300 years later, which means, and this is where the notion, so if the Bible is codified, redacted, put together, written in exile, that means that the Jews of Babylon are still in connection with the Jews of Egypt,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Which suggests that some of the biblical text you would think would have been written previously, or there had to be some core notions about the universe that existed prior to the Babylonian exile. Otherwise, those two communities wouldn't feel so connected. Right?
Right.
And again, how many Jews from Babylon go to Egypt? I got nothing, right? And we don't have, you know, records mm-hmm. of their plane travel. And so we don't know, you know, how they're connecting and who's going back and forth. And, you know, you got Jeremiah and you've got Ezekiel and they're going different places, blah, mm-hmm. blah, 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 blah. And then, so for some reason, the Jews of Alexandria are, there are enough of them and their Hebrew is bad enough, and they have bought into the notion that there is at least a book of Moses or a law of Moses to which they feel responsible and that they're adherents to and are supposed to be presenting and they're supposed to be reading on a regular basis, right? So this notion that you read the Bible out loud or at least the Torah is old. Otherwise, you wouldn't have had a translator for the Jews of Egypt, right? Which
right.
kind of undermines my, you know, they're just Judeans and then they become Jews, right?
Right.
A little bit, but not so much. So you've got that notion that transcends boundaries, right? And reinforces this idea that we're no longer adherents to a deity who lost, but rather, you know, this was our punishment. And again, they're staying in Egypt even though they have rebuilt the second temple because it's nice in Egypt, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing well and that's where they live, right? And that's this whole, you know, where do you belong thing,
right? And
right?
it's a big deal to move at this time too. It would take two generations to get there. It'd be a different group of people.
Well, and it's this whole, you know, where do you belong,
mm-hmm.
right? And how long do you belong in somewhere until they decide you don't belong there anymore,
right? Right.
And so the Jews of Egypt decide they're going to translate it into Greek because Egypt and especially the upper class are speaking Greek now, right? Because it's post Alexander the Great, and Alexander the Great's generals took over. One of them took over Egypt. Ptolemy did, and you have another one, the Seleucids in Syria, right? And the border between those two keeps shifting, right? But they're all Greek speakers. And so that's why it gets translated into Greek, because that way more people can understand it. And so it is translated with an eye towards these people are adherents still to this text, but they no longer understand the original text, right?
Right, right.
Which is why you keep, right?
Right.
Why one translates a text, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then the question becomes, and here's, you know, so for Christianity, the Christian theology comes from the Septuagint. So Christian theology comes from the Greek and then later the Latin, right? And Latin and Greek are not the same, and you have different concepts, right?
And they're definitely not Hebrew, yeah.
And they are so not Hebrew.
Right.
So you've got this community that can't understand its text in the original, but they're perfectly happy taking it in this other language, right? Because that's who they are. Did that explain
Absolutely.
What you wanted me to explain?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
And they're also not going back.
Yeah, we're staying here, which speaks to that
Egyptians.
Whole identity thing. Yeah, we're recrafting this. We're new people. We got to be strong. We're a thing. We're here. We're proud. We're loud. We're here.
And it also means that we're no longer, again, it does reinforce my earlier argument that it's no longer a place-based thing, because if it were a place-based thing, then they wouldn't be able to stay in Egypt, right? But they've reconfigured the religion that it's about something bigger than just a god who lives on top of this little mountain in the middle of nowhere. Right? Which actually, you know, in terms of coming up with intellectually is huge, especially when everybody around you is like, what are you talking about? There's a bunch of gods and mine's better because I just conquered you and you just lost. Like, how stupid are you? Right? I mean, it goes completely against the grain.
Yeah. I've heard, this is of course for next season, but I've heard, you know, a similar argument for, you know, second, third, fourth century Christianity.
Right.
Your Messiah died.
Right.
He's supposed to be another David and slaughter and king. He died.
Yeah.
Oh, no, he didn't. Well, but that's another.
Right.
Let's put a pin in it right there because I want to highlight something. You see how much history and context you have to go through before we can even approach the text? We didn't even get to reading yet. Got to save that for next time, part two. In the meantime, let's recap how scripture developed over the centuries. Here's Dr. Schneider.
You go from scroll-based to like paper-based to mm-hmm. like pamphlet-based mm-hmm. to book-based, right? Mm-hmm. And then you go to printed book because you finally have a printing press. And now we're in this, you know, cell phone-based, right? Mm-hmm. And so on some levels, the order of the books become random and less meaningful because they're not, you know, on your phone. It doesn't care
right.
what the order of the
you
books
is. You
don't
have this tactile and scroll through and let me get there.
Right, right. You don't put stuff in the margins and you don't decorate the cover of it.
Right.
Blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So I guess we have a lot more digging to do, and I promise we'll start reading at the top of the next episode. So join me where I'll always be, live from Studio B at Claremont Graduate University. My name's Jeannie, and this is Scripture Unearthed.